Hello and welcome to a very special clinical oncology podcast. My name is Saif Ahmed and I'm also joined by Finbas Levin, who has co-hosted this episode. We recently published a fantastic special issue on bladder radiotherapy, guest edited by Professor Robert Huddart. And in this podcast, we are joined by an expert group of panelists, including key authors from the special issue, for a hugely educational and thought-provoking discussion on the current challenges and opportunities in bladder radiotherapy. One of the many really fascinating discussions centered around the merits of surgery versus radiotherapy. And before anyone thinks we are biased towards radiotherapy, Professor Jim Catto, who provides an expert surgical perspective on things, was delayed and unable to make the start of the panel discussion, but joined us towards the end to provide some fantastic additional insights. Now, without further ado, we can get things started, and we'll start off by hearing an introduction from our co-host, Finn.
Yeah, hello, I'm Finn Slevin. I'm a clinical oncology trainee in Leeds, and I'm also a trainee editorial board member for the Clinical Oncology Journal.
So thanks to the distinguished panel. If people could just go around introducing themselves. Rob, would you like to just kick off as the lead?
Hi, thanks, Saif. I'm Robert Huddart. I'm a clinical oncologist. I work out of the Institute of Cancer Research and the Royal Marsden in London. I'm a specialist in bladder cancer and had the privilege to edit the special edition on bladder radiotherapy that's just been published in Clinical Oncology.
So yes, thanks. I'm Mohini Varaghese. I'm consultant clinical oncologist based in the Southwest, working at the Royal Devon and Exeter Hospital. I look after several tumour sites, subsites, prostate and bladder. I have a real passion for trying to improve outcomes for bladder cancer.
Thank you, Mohini. Lydia?
Yes, my name is Lydia Makarov. I'm the chief executive of Fight Bladder Cancer, which is a charity based in the UK supporting people affected by bladder cancer. And I'm also the vice president of the World Bladder Cancer Patient Coalition, which is an umbrella organization of all of the national bladder cancer patient organizations around the world.
Thank you, Lydia. And Valerie?
Hi, I'm Valerie Fontaine, radiation oncologist from Ghent University Hospital in Belgium. My main focus is uro-oncology and with a specific interest for prostate and bladder cancer.
Thank you. Rob, I just wanted to kick things off by asking about how you got involved with guest editing this fantastic special issue.
Thanks, Saif. Interested in the management of bladder cancer, and generally speaking, bladder cancer is one of those areas that's often been neglected. And the results that we have achieved in the past could have been improved. The overall survival is not where we want it to be, and there's also big issues in terms of the quality of life and survivorship for patients who have suffered from bladder cancer. As a clinical oncologist, I do quite a lot of bladder radiotherapy, and there's been a lot of development in bladder radiotherapy in recent years, and its role in the management of muscle-invasive bladder cancer has been somewhat controversial, but I see it as a growing option for patients with locally advanced disease. And as an area of developing interest, I thought the time was right to try to pull together expertise from across the globe to look at best practice in bladder radiotherapy and to try to place the role of bladder radiotherapy in the modern management of patients who have muscle-invasive bladder cancer. And that's led to the addition. So I was in the position of putting forward an idea to clinical oncology to do this special edition, and invited lots of friends, colleagues from around the world to take part. And I was actually delighted in how many enthusiastically said yes. And the special edition has just been published. So I hope it's a good read and interesting subject matter for discussion.
So thank you very much, everyone. The first question we wanted to discuss was how the management of bladder cancer has changed in recent years. And it'd be great to bring in the view from the clinicians and then also from Lydia.
The treatment for bladder cancer with regards to muscle-invasive bladder cancer has changed with regards to how far we've come with regards to radiotherapy technique. We have come on in leaps and bounds with regards to trying to optimize dosage to the bladder whilst trying to minimize dose to normal structures through the use of modern radiotherapy techniques. Necessary when you consider that the bladder is essentially as mobile as a balloon. And in addition to optimizing radiotherapy techniques, it's the national and international standard of using concurrent chemoradiosensitization as well.
Thank you very much, Mohini. Valerie, do you have a view on that?
Yes, from my side of view, I think that for metastatic bladder cancer, there has been quite some improvement with the venue of immunotherapy with excellent results in a subgroup of patients. In the primary non-metastatic bladder cancer patients, I don't think that many has changed, and the outcome over time hasn't improved a lot. Surgery is still considered standard of care. But nevertheless, despite the fact that radiotherapy in many countries is still underused, I'm quite positive and optimistic, because radiotherapy at least is entering in the scene. It is more discussed in multidisciplinary discussions. It's more discussed at congresses, and now we have also this publication. So I'm positive that radiotherapy will increase. We have made an enormous step forward considering techniques. So there is nothing to say about the technical approaches, but it's more the implementation of radiotherapy itself that is still a matter of concern to me.
Thanks. I think I would agree with both those sentiments. And actually, what we've seen is progress in a number of areas. I'm sure that our surgical colleagues would say there's been progress in the surgical arena as well, in terms of better and safer surgery. And I think the challenge for us is to take these developments in systemic treatment and to use that to be able to deliver that with radiotherapy, with surgery, to get a better long-term outcomes for our patients, to preserve more bladders and to have more people surviving the bladder cancer illness. And it's all about using what we can do optimally and trying to drive forward further research. And we know a lot more now about the genetics, the background, the biology of bladder cancer. And there's a lot of it. I think we should be quite excited about the potential role of interacting radiation treatments with such things as immunotherapy, which is one of the areas that we discussed within the special edition.
Thank you very much. I'd be interested, Lydia, from the patient's point of view, if you've got these different treatment options, surgery and radiotherapy or chemo radiotherapy, how do you think about that from the patient's point of view, and what sort of information would help patients when they're trying to make their decisions about treatment?
Yeah, well, I think there needs to be a very clear conversations about the likelihood and the severity of short-term and long-term side effects. So very clear communications and conversations about sex and intimacy, especially because these do have an impact. Also exploring the duration of treatment as well. So would patients prefer a bladder sparing treatment with perhaps a longer duration of treatment, or a surgery with a shorter duration of treatment? How do they feel about follow-up surveillance? How do they feel about their own body image and, you know, their relationship with their loved ones and their relationship with the partners? So I think there just needs to be a lot of very frank and open conversations about what happens after these treatments.
Thank you. Thank you very much for that sort of patient perspective there, Lydia. So just sort of bringing in the clinicians on the other side of the coin then, clearly there are lots of nuances to what treatment someone should be receiving. How would you as experts sort of summarize what the key issues are and the key things that we need to weigh up when thinking about standard of care of treatment for patients with localized muscle invasive bladder cancer? Mohini, if you wanted to give your take first.
I would actually say that the key is a multidisciplinary approach And that patients have the opportunity to meet both a urologist and a clinical oncologist with subspecialty interest in bladder cancer. Often these decisions are made remote from the patient. Often these decisions, there may be a certain influence within a multidisciplinary meeting, regionally or nationally, that one modality, and typically surgery, is superior to bladder preservation. And actually, when you dig deep, the data really isn't robust enough to support that, which has led to the discordance of international guidelines, actually, with regards to what to suggest as optimal for patients. So I think the key, I would say, to my registrars is multidisciplinary review. And these are complex discussions to have. I think patients also require CNS support, dedicated CNS support. And we know there's a lack of dedicated bladder CNSs throughout the UK. And that would certainly help with these complex decisions. And finally, knowing that our population is elderly. So in 2016, we looked at the UK, the English population of non-metastatic muscle-invasive bladder cancer, and the average age was 76. So although we have demonstrated clear benefit of various interventions, neoadjuvant chemotherapy, radical treatments, radical concurrent radiosensitization, there is a mismatch between utilization and uptake because I don't think we understand fully the implications of comorbidity on treatment decisions.
Well, I absolutely agree that we should evolve towards a patient-centered and multidisciplinary approach, starting from the diagnosis, where in a multidisciplinary panel, one should revise all features of the patients and then come towards a treatment approach that can be discussed then in a multidisciplinary consultation with the patients. I think that we underestimate the impact of the urinary diversions, not only in the long, but also, and not only in the short term, but also in the long term. So I think that the patient should be centralized in the decision, and a multidisciplinary consultation can help the patients to make a decision that is most suited for the patient itself. And hopefully with time, we will also have some biological markers that can guide us towards further patient-tailored approaches. But absolutely, multidisciplinarity will be the key of improvement of patients' quality of life and outcome.
Yes, it's a really difficult area. As Mohini was saying, there's a lot of suggestion that patients have a better survival with radical cystectomy. But if you look carefully into the data, there's very little evidence to support that. We did try to run a trial in the UK that I was involved with, called the SPARE trial. And actually, it was really, really difficult, partly because there were clearly biases from the people from the clinicians taking part in the study. But probably more importantly, there was also it was quite clear that it's a very personal decision for patients. And actually, to run a randomized trial was just about impossible because, and when you think about it, who would want to be said, well, are you willing to be randomly selected to have your bladder surgery or not have a bladder surgery? It is actually surprising anyone said yes in a way. So we soon found out that wasn't really going to work. And I think that's going to be a problem going forward if we're looking between two different modalities. The reality is that where there's a genuine choice is more restricted than we give it credit for. And there's, there's obviously patients with significant comorbidity where surgery is quite dangerous. And there's patients who have significant problems with the bladder where radiotherapy is probably not going to help people in the long term in terms of their quality of life. So it's perhaps not, and there's patients whose cancers are really quite nasty, where actually the question really is whether or not we should be using both treatments to maximize long-term outcomes, which again was something we looked at within our the special edition. So we do have this argument quite often, but actually it is a question of looking at the individual and for all the factors that my colleagues have suggested, I think are really important. And there's no right answer for every single person. And I think it's probably, if every one of your patients is having one treatment, you're probably not doing your job correctly in terms of counselling.
Thank you. And some really, really fantastic insights there. And there's a couple of clear take-homes. But one in particular around the SPARE trial. So in healthcare, you know, randomised studies are really important to push us forward. And you highlighted some of the issues around, even though there was sort of perceived equipoise, that, you know, both could be the right thing for the patient, there was a real challenge around recruitment. So it'd be really helpful to hear any insights on the clinician's end as to what was learnt out of the SPARE trial and maybe how that could have been done differently. But I thought maybe, Lydia, if you could go first and sort of give your views on that whole side of things.
Yeah, it was interesting to look at the data of the SPARE trial. And of course, I agree with Robert there that it is very challenging to randomize something that has such different outcomes. But looking at the data that was there, even though it did have very low number of patients, we did see a trend towards people who receiving bladder sparing treatments did have fewer sort of severe life-threatening or disabling adverse events. So that was a signal which was quite interesting to look at. And then I think what we've also seen is people who do have surgery tended to score their overall health and quality of life slightly lower than those who had radiotherapy. But as we've also heard, that the people who were candidates for both are quite small, so it's a very complex issue, and I think it's only in these multidisciplinary conversations that we can really explore it and decide what is right for the person and have these conversations and involve the patient in joint decision making.
I should say one of the things I think we learned from the SPARE trial was actually the complexity of the pathway for the patient, and when we mapped out who the patient might meet, there was the original urologist, there may be a local urology CNS, then they may be referred to a center and see a medical oncologist, potentially then see a specialist urological surgeon with their CNS, perhaps a radiation oncologist. And it was quite a long, it was complex pathway. In terms of running a trial, we found it just needed one person in all the numerous people. It could be the GP, there's GPs involved, there's general nurses, stoma nurses as well. You only need one person who had a particularly strong viewpoint about that actually could affect the equipoise of everybody in the pathway. So it was actually the lessons were you need equipoise in everybody to make this sort of thing successful in terms of a trial. And actually also how complicated the journey is for a person, how difficult it must be to make the decision as to how to proceed. We did see in the trial of the people who were given information about the trial who declined, about two-thirds of the patients wanted to have bladder preservation and about a third of patients elected to have surgery. So these are patients who weren't randomized. And even in the patients who were randomized, there was some people who decided they wanted to have the opposite treatment. So it doesn't always work one way, but there was certainly an appetite in the patients that were approached for the bladder preservation route. I don't know if Valerie, you got any insights from Europe regarding this issue?
Well, from my point of view, the most interesting part of the SPARE trial was the fact indeed that two-thirds of the patients rather wanted to have a bladder sparing approach. And certainly in Belgium, but in many other countries, this is often not discussed with the patient as a treatment option. So in fact, you will deny a curative treatment that is quite often the preferred treatment option from a patient point of view by not discussing this treatment option with the patient. So that was my main lesson, and it was one of the reasons why I wanted to renew a little bit the research in Belgium regarding three modality for bladder cancer patients, based on this finding that most patients are really keen in preserving their bladder and having probably a better quality of life afterwards. So that was my main lesson from the SPARE trial. And it is a real pity that the trial didn't succeed to go for full recruitment, to also have the what is sometimes regarded as hard endpoints, overall survival, but I think that we should not neglect quality of life and patient preference.
Thank you. I thought that was a really, really interesting discussion. Mohini, I can see your hands up.
Yeah, I just wanted to ask Robert and Valerie, actually. So in many other tumour sites, we have moved from very difficult surgery, for example, the Halsted mastectomy, to wide local excision and radiotherapy, or gone away from very mutilating head and neck dissections to chemoradiotherapy. And for anal cancer, chemoradiotherapy is a standard. Do you think the pathway in bladder cancer is unique and has impeded the uptake of chemoradiotherapy for bladder patients?
I don't know if Valerie wants to take that, come in on this, but I think when you go to meetings, both urological and radiotherapy, you have people stand up and just say, and the management is cystectomy. Mm-hmm. And there's almost like there's no further discussion regarding it. And maybe that position has softened a little bit more recently, when there's started to be some credence of it. But it's very inbuilt that it's taught all the way from medical school through oncology, and it's not just in the surgical community that's been taught, but it's also taught in medical oncology colleagues that this is how you manage bladder cancer, and actually an alternative is not often considered. And I think there's a lot of momentum. And one of the interesting corollaries is regarding the BC2001 trial and the trials in anal cancer, where the actual local control, the overall survival rates between 5-FU mitomycin C primed chemoradiotherapy for anal cancer and for bladder cancer are actually very similar. And in anal cancer, that was sufficiently good to switch from radical surgery, which was an AP resection, to a anal conserving treatment. But the same sort of data hasn't achieved the same switch in bladder cancer. Maybe we weren't ready for it at the time that the chemo radiotherapy trials were first published. And it certainly has made an impact, I think, in terms of people's perception, but I think we're not quite there yet. And I make that analogy within the special edition, just highlighting that issue that if it's good enough for anal cancer, maybe it should be good enough for bladder cancer. We've reflected it isn't just about survival and long-term outcome, but there are other issues in quality of life and follow-up and recurrence that we need to consider, but it should be the starting point. And I do sometimes think that the question about what the choice is framed from often the question that's asked is, why shouldn't I do a cystectomy, rather than the question which I think it should be, which is, why should I do a cystectomy? A radical cystectomy isn't necessarily wrong to recommend to a patient, but it should be thought out about, this is the reason why it's right for this individual. And maybe that would put us in a better position to look across the whole field if we did so.
Well, I agree that for many pathologies, we are evolving to more organ preservation. So we should go the same way with bladder cancer. But it's like you mentioned, we've learned at medical school that surgery is the preferred option. And I also quite often have the impression that there is a dogma that bladder cancer is a radio-resistant tumor, and that radiotherapy is still considered as being a very toxic treatment approach. And these are certainly, in my country, are quite often still referred to as reasons why not referring patients for tri-modality therapy, unfortunately.
That's really interesting. Thank you very much. I wondered if we might move the discussion towards issues regarding survivorship and long-term morbidity for patients. And I wondered how patients can be best supported following their treatment, whether that's surgery or non-surgery. I wondered, Lydia, whether you might talk about that first of all.
We've heard before that the important role of clinical nurse specialists, and I think again here, this is just so important that patients are given the contact details of the clinical nurse specialist at the beginning of their bladder cancer experience, and that once again, the clinical nurse specialist supports them during survivorship. But a lot of patients say that they've had to be very pushy to receive follow-up care and support, because we hear that there's such a battle for resources between long-term follow-up of patients and the service to diagnose new patients. And a lot of clinical nurse specialists say that they simply don't have the time to make a phone call and follow up with individual patients. So I think that we need a great investment in the workforce, especially more clinical nurse specialists to support the survivorship of bladder cancer patients.
And are there any sort of other resources or services that could be a benefit, do you think?
Well, the patient support groups like Fight Bladder Cancer have a lot of services as well. So we have a private forum where a lot of patients go to share their experiences with others. We have support groups currently online at the moment. And we do find that this sort of community and peer support really helps. And people can also see others as well. When you're surrounded by a community of other people who have survived treatment and who are going on to live their life and are now celebrating other milestones, then that can also really help morale as well. Because if you're speaking to people who are 5, 10, 15 years post-diagnosis, post-treatment, then that can give you an understanding of how your survivorship journey is going to look. We also, Fight Bladder Cancer also has a patient information booklet called Surviving Bladder Cancer, which outlines what will happen after the acute treatment phase has ended.
I'd be interested in the perspective from Heaney and Valerie regarding survivorship as well.
I think there's a real push in the UK, or certainly England, to try to discharge patients after their radical treatment and to initiate patient-centred referral back into the hospital. We're not there yet with bladder cancer, and I don't think there's any clear standard for follow-up for patients with their bladder cancer, apart from the regular surveillance cystoscopy. And that was highlighted in NICE research needed to be, in the NICE guidelines, research needs to be done to try and optimise or work out optimal follow-up for patients. But just thinking about, we are clearly looking for local recurrence, but there remains a risk of metastatic disease, and historically our options were limited, particularly in an elderly population, but with the understanding that immunotherapy is now beneficial, particularly in platinum ineligible patients, it's more suitable for elderly patients, that there is probably a role for closer radiological follow-up. And in addition, I think we need to also consider about the monitoring of radiotherapy side effects quite closely and referral into specialist services should patients develop that. And that's not just for bladder cancer, that's for any cancer really.
Well, I think that besides the oncological follow-up that was already mentioned by Mohini, One aspect that is quite often forgotten is physical activity. We deal with an elderly population, and physical activity is something that is it has been proven that it improves the long-term outcome, that it improves quality of life, and it has such a major impact. But nevertheless, there are no real care pathways implementing physical activity either prior to an operation or after operation, and it's an area that is neglected, while there is absolutely no reason for it. I think that quality of life would definitely improve if we also take physical activity programs into consideration in the follow-up of our patients. I don't know if Lydia can agree on that.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think, once again, we need to look at people as a whole who are surviving bladder cancer. So it's the person that we're treating, not just the cancer. So we need to look at psychological support. We need to look at nutritional support, physical activity, treat the whole person, not just focus on removing the tumor within the person.
And from that respect, I think that patients who have a urinary diversion are more hampered in their physical activity more than patients who receive a trimodality therapy. So I think that that the physical activity is more hampered for patients with a radical cystectomy than for patients with trimodality therapy. But it is something that is ignored, according to me.
I think whatever we do, I think there's room for improvement. Having been involved in the NICE guidance a few years ago, it was quite striking that certainly in the UK, patient satisfaction ratings for bladder cancer were worst of all cancers. And I think this reflects on the lack of those specialist services, the lack of the support, the lack of time actually given to bladder cancer in hospitals. A lot of that is dominated by the management of non-muscle invasive cancer, not necessarily muscle invasive cancer, but I think it reflects across the board, really. Certainly it's an area that we could make big strides to improve survivorship in.
Thank you. And some, again, really rich discussion. I think that leads on really well to one of the concepts discussed in the special issue as well, where sort of bladder cancer was referred to as a Cinderella cancer compared to other cancers, meaning that other cancers maybe seem to have better outcomes or they have a better profile. So why do people think that is, and how can that situation be improved? And perhaps Mohini, you can kick off on that.
So when I sit in clinic, I see a real difference between managing my prostate and breast patients and my bladder patients. I've been trying to work out why this is, and I think it's because when I put breast and prostate patients into clinical trials, I'm putting patients who are typical and representative of the population into clinical trials. So when I see other patients in those populations, I can then quite easily give them evidence-based medicine. In bladder cancer, I'm trying to make a judgment about whether this evidence-based treatment is going to fit this patient with their unique set of comorbidities, who is typically elderly. And even with my trying my hardest, things can go wrong with neoadjuvant chemotherapy or the concurrent radiotherapy that we just are not predicting. I think we know from the RCR audit that 8% of patients went into study. Into clinical trials. So that was across the muscle invasive population. So that's a relatively low number. In the other tumour sites of breast and prostate, we have seen an exponential rise in the last 20 years of clinical trials. We need to do that in bladder cancer and not only increase the number of clinical trials, make the trials relevant for the patients that we are seeing. We need to look at oncogeriatric manoeuvres, perhaps, as mentioned already, in the post-treatment setting, look at prehabilitation measures as well to try and increase the number of patients who are suitable for radical treatment as well. There's lots to do, and I think there's underrepresentation of clinical trials that are relevant to our population, but also I think the voice of the patient historically has been muted, and we need to celebrate charities like Fight Bladder Cancer and encourage that, because we have seen a real change in treatments in other tumour sites such as breast and prostate from patient voice.
Valerie, it'd be interesting to hear sort of on sort of mainland Europe, would you say that's a similar theme?
Well, it's similar. With the immuno trials, there is somewhat more interest in bladder cancer from an industrial point of view and a financial point of view. But I think that, again, the dogma that bladder cancer is a bad tumor with a bad prognosis and there is only one treatment, radical cystectomy, is also part of the problem, that there is not that much interest in trials in the setting of bladder cancer. I definitely hope that broader trials from a radiation oncology point of view, then specifically on radiotherapy, can help us to move forward and to help us to decide what the place of radiotherapy is. It's very hard to do it from a national on a national base due to a number of problems that we're all facing with. All similar, radiotherapy is not an attractive treatment option for bladder cancer, unfortunately, nowadays. So I I'm positive. With immunotherapy, bladder cancer has catched attention again. And I think that radiotherapy can have another a renewed interest if we work together, not only on a nation-based from a nation-based approach, but really worldwide, big trials, in fact.
Yeah, I think Valerie has touched on exactly one of the issues. And until about 5 years ago, there hadn't really been a new treatment approach or a new drug for treating patients with bladder cancer for best part of two decades. And And that meant there was very little research interest and there was very little focus on bladder cancer. It wasn't really seen by a lot of the companies that developed new drugs as something actually worth investing in. And that's left to a lack of specialism and people with an interest to actually take bladder cancer forward. And when you run a urological service, you're bladder cancer patient, you get one bladder cancer patient, you get 10, 15 prostate cancer patients. And I think that patient gets lost in that practice. And certainly I know from our local experience, switching to have a specific clinic for our patients with bladder cancer made a huge difference to how we could see and organize our services for looking after patients with bladder cancer. We may be in a fortunate position that many people aren't able to do that, but I think it's that focus and the loss of the patient in the mass of other urological patients, which are perhaps slightly more fashionable, prostate cancer and kidney cancer, for instance, that has left bladder cancer behind.
Thank you, and Lydia, not to put you on the spot, but I guess the counterpoint would be that there are so many cancers out there, let alone so many different diseases out there. So from your point of view, why should additional resource and attention be put on bladder cancer? What are your thoughts on that?
Well, when we look at the statistics, we see that there's over 20,000 patients in the UK each year who are diagnosed with bladder cancer, which makes it the fifth most common cancer in the UK. And it's also extremely expensive to follow up, because a lot of the current follow-up that we have is very resource intensive. So I would say that even just looking independently and objectively at the statistics, it's really imperative that we have more resources towards bladder cancer, because it's such a neglected disease, and yet over 20,000 people per year in the UK are being diagnosed with it.
Yeah, I think some of the issues around why the outcomes might not be so good, and the kind of the problems with the pathways have been highlighted in the discussion. Mohini, I know in the recent audit, RCR audit that you led, you identified that there was poor concordance with national standards, particularly in relation to diagnostic pathways, as well as in relation to treatments, including radiotherapy. So I wondered what everyone thought could be done to try and improve that situation.
So part of the reason for doing the audit was this frustration that outcomes weren't improving despite these interventions that are proven to be of benefit. And there was clearly some mismatch between guidelines and what was happening on the ground. And as you said, Finn, it was the first time we actually measured the time from TURBT to definitive treatment, be it neoadjuvant chemotherapy or radiotherapy, in the UK, and I think internationally as well. And TURBT up until this time had been classified as a first treatment. And you would never imagine any other cancer patient accepting the piecemeal biopsy as a treatment. And with that identification that neoadjuvant patients were waiting 2 months after the TURBT to start chemo, or 3 months after the TURBT on average around the UK start radical radiotherapy, Lydia, it added to the evidence that Lydia had to canvass NHS England to change TURBT from a treatment to a diagnostic procedure, where other treatments were then indicated by the MDT. And then also, although there's discordance with in international guidance as to whether organ preservation is this at the same level as cystectomy, where there is concordance is that when radiotherapy is considered in a radical intent, it should be given with concurrent radiosensitization. So we wanted to measure that uptake within the UK. And actually, it was very disappointing to see that it was just 44% of centres chemo radiotherapy, which was disappointingly low.
Thank you, Moni. I guess just bringing in Jim, I guess, who's just joined us. I don't know
Sorry, I'm late. Always best laid plans and all that.
Thank you so much. I mean, we are coming towards the end, but Jim, you're such a vital sort of cog piece to this discussion. So it's great to have you, actually. I hope it's okay for you to introduce yourself for our audience, and then Rob can fill you in on the discussion so far.
I'm Jim Catto. I'm a urological surgeon in the University of Sheffield and an NIHR professor.
So Jim, we were talking about the potential role of bladder radiotherapy for patients with muscle-invasive bladder cancer. We reflect on some of the SPARE data, how SPARE failed to recruit patients, how patients within the SPARE trial who turned down randomization, there was a sort of 2-to-1 ratio for going for bladder preservation versus surgery. And it's really a question of how you feel about, we also talked about how there isn't one fit for all, and actually perhaps for patients where there's a genuine choice, it's actually a small subset of patients rather than a large number of patients where there is a major choice. So it's really your reflections on that data, which I think you know pretty well. And so what's your perceptions on radical cystectomy, and also what the role of radiotherapy is at all in the current management?
So my view is I think you need radical treatment and a good discussion with the right people, and I think far more people are harmed by not having that discussion and choice and also getting appropriate treatment. I don't know, without really comparative data, and you know, SPARE did the best effort you could do, it's always difficult to really know which is better for whom. I think, like you say, the true number of people who really can have both options, I think, is smaller than we think. And I think for some people, surgery is probably a better option. And for others, probably radiotherapy is a better option. And then in the middle, I definitely think people who've got maybe more localized solid tumors with good bladder function and want to keep sexual function, then radiotherapy is probably preferable. I think other people with obstruction, bad bladders, bigger tumors, I suspect surgery is better. I don't know the answer, but I think in my view has been to try and optimize surgery as much as possible, not at the extent of excluding radiotherapy, but just saying, you know, in our local practice, we have a lot of, like everybody, most of our patients are older and less fit, and a lot of them seem to come along with bigger, bulkier tumors, so they tend to be more surgical candidates. And we've gone down the road of trying to optimize surgery as best possible, so, you know, make it a less morbid approach. And then looking at the data about PROMS and our LABC survey, which Mohini's well-versed in part of, we've tried to work through as to what are the outcomes that matter to patients, and maybe we can work on those.
I think that's helpful. Maybe you just want to highlight a little bit what you found in your PROMS study. And
So
we were discussing also lots of survivorship issues and how we possibly could improve matters for patients in the future.
So we've just completed life and bladder cancer, which is about just under 2,000 patients replied from about just under 4,000 who were invited. And fundamentally, we looked at lots of different metrics or lots of different things, but we found effectively that quality of life is mostly driven actually by patient fitness, performance status and comorbidities rather than the treatments they received. So the overall quality of life is very much driven by patient fitness and performance status. And that means that accumulation of treatments doesn't have a detrimental effect. So adding neoadjuvant treatment to radical treatment doesn't make it worse. Adding intravesicles to local treatment doesn't make it worse. We then found that sexual function is a big problem. And again, as with prostate work, it's undercovered really. So men scored loss of sex function as one of the biggest problems. But that was for all patients, whether they'd had a cystectomy or just TURBT. So a component of that is probably age-related changes. And then a lot of women didn't answer that question at all. They avoided the answer. So that suggests there's an unmet need there that's not really well studied. We saw financial toxicity was an issue. So in the under 65, we saw that there was concerns about finances. So, you know, whether that's lots of trips to hospital, so time off work for cystoscopies, intravesical treatment, whether that's lots of trips to hospital for radical radiotherapy or for radical surgery and prolonged time off work. And then we saw that we could compare the quality of life of people with bladder cancer with those with other pelvic cancers, so prostate, gynecological cancers, and we saw that their overall quality of life was worse than the comparative question. So that again taps into the kind of unmet need, lots of problems out there, but we've not really addressed them to date. But the good news for us was that a lot of the treatments didn't seem to have major downsides in patients' quality of life. So in other words, I guess we should be taking the best oncological approach for each cancer rather than trying to balance it up with a less aggressive approach.
And we were discussing about how we could potentially improve survivorship. Have you got any insights into what you would recommend in terms of follow-up and support? Anything that we could do better?
Well, I think from that, you know, I think we're now trying to look at financial support for people who are younger, so trying to flag up the solutions and options they've got available to give them more financial support. Again, talking about sex is really important, trying to talk about sex beforehand. I think a lot of the time it's about warning and preparing patients. So, you know, bladder cancer is a lot more aggressive than prostate. So it's not like you could say, let's not have any treatment or let's take a more conservative route, because generally bladder is a lethal cancer. But I think if patients are forewarned and know what to expect and are well informed, then that leads to less upset later on. And then maybe more solutions with sort of erectile recovery or even sort of vaginal sparing approaches for sexual function in those populations. It comes down to a lot of things. Lydia's nodding, but it's a lack of probably nursing support, a lack of time support, and a lack of a priority of these patients in the NHS pathway.
I'm glad to hear that you repeated quite a few things that that I said and Lydia said and Mohini said earlier. So there's obviously some consensus there. How do we get to the situation where we can provide that support. Do we need to be developing more specialist bladder cancer services? And if so, how would we go about that?
I think we do, but I suspect that we're on the road to that by getting the information. So, you know, now we've highlighted that these are concerns for patients. There's almost a duty of response from our commissioners now to say, well, you know, we notice that the quality of life, we know from the NHS patient experience survey that bladder kidney cancer experiences are poor. So I think it's collecting that information, and then you can go back to your commissioners and say, hey, you're supposed to be serving your population. Here's areas of unmet need. So you need to give the resource. And I think historically over the time, we've not had that information to be able to go back to our commissioners and our funders to say, look, we do need CNS support. We do need specialist bladder cancer clinic support. Without doubt, I think a bladder cancer service is vital. You know, in Sheffield, we have pretty much the same anaesthetist all the time. We have a team of about three or four cystectomists. We have a bladder cancer clinic called UCCO1 where all the new cases get discussed every week. All the difficult ones come every week. It's now become, you know, one of the main flagships of urology, that all the patients with bladder cancer, if there's a problem, put them into UCCO1. We start with a review of all the new cases coming in. We talk about what's coming next week, check all the scans are organized and up to date before we start seeing the clinic. Before we start seeing the patients, and that has definitely helped breaches pathways, and it just becomes somewhere where if you're concerned about bladder cancer patient that you've come across in another environment, you can put them into that clinic, and then they'll get discussed each week. So I think services like that help a lot, and they're actually not that resource heavy because a lot of these patients are being seen in the service anyway.
And I think we've certainly noticed just a help by having within our central MDT mechanism concentrating all the bladder cancer patients together, rather than, you know, when we first started in the MDT, they'd be all over the place, and people who are then specifically interested in bladder cancer and get together and discuss. And actually, that list seems to have grown over the last couple of years. And I think that's really helped our service.
I also think, Rob, that there is a need, and this is a slightly more difficult question. I think there's a need for kind of supra-regional specialist bladder subclinics. So we have a spinal injuries unit in Sheffield, so we get quite a lot of people with squamous cell cancers, but they need a different, you know, they get treated the same, but their outcomes are worse than a lot of other patients, and maybe women as well. You know, maybe people with unusual bladder cancers probably need to be seen at maybe a super regional level, because they probably require more experience and different options available. You know, adjuvant radiotherapy, perhaps. There's different approaches we need to be using. But whilst we're all seeing one of them a month or one of them a year, there just isn't that critical mass of it.
I think that's a very, very interesting observation. I know we've had similar discussions about rapid access clinics and such like as well, but it's quite difficult getting that momentum moving forward.
I think, but if you look at like guys with like the RPF service that Tim O'Brien set up, they just put an open call out to say, these are difficult patients. You know, we have a zero threshold to take a patient as a referral. And because I think most clinicians want the best for their patients and are open to it, then I think, you know, you can do that in the NHS. It's probably having the energy to set yourself up as that person or that team.
Thank you. This has been really fantastic and builds on really nicely some of the earlier discussion. I just wanted to, I'm conscious of people's time, but just to round things off, I personally, you know, taken a lot away, but I think there clearly are a lot of sort of unmet needs in the context of improving bladder cancer treatment. And I just wanted to put a bit of a flippant question out there, but sort of sticking with the Cinderella analogy from earlier, if a fairy godmother came and said, okay, each of you can have £1 million to spend, £1 million to spend on improving the bladder cancer service, either sort of regionally or nationally, what one thing would you guys spend that on? What do you think is the lowest hanging fruit in it?
Well, I would like to do those sort of super regional, unusual bladder cancer setups, because I think, a lot of it like more rapid pathway. Lydia has really led on TURBT seeing as an investigation, not a treatment. And I think that's made a massive difference. And as that comes through, I think the work that Nick James has done with MRI and imaging, that's going to bear fruit already. But I think the other ones are a super regional service. I don't know what the other people are interested in saying.
I would go for developing a good care pathway with a multidisciplinary team, from diagnosis till treatment till long-term follow-up. And therefore, you need a lot of money.
Absolutely. And Mohini?
I'd concur, actually. I'd use that money for a specialist MDT with key stakeholders in there, making sure there's multiple bladders, CNSs, and also access to onco-geriatrics as well.
Lydia?
I would love to see that every single bladder cancer patient has the contact details of a bladder cancer clinical nurse specialist who can also signpost to peer support and patient support organisations and make sure that the patients are also receiving the correct patient information booklets.
I think I'm investing my money where Valerie and Jim are going, which is to have a seamless multidisciplinary bladder clinic. Which would take patients from original suspected cancer through to the management and then the ongoing care. But importantly, a rapid access service so we can get patients from the original presentation to the urologist through to the radical treatment as speedily as possible. As Mohini has highlighted, that has been suboptimal for many years and an area that is a low hanging fruit to improve quality of care.
It's really, really interesting discussion. I feel like we've covered so many issues and brought out a lot of the kind of the problems with the current situation, but also suggested some potentially really valuable solutions.
Thanks everyone. I totally agree with that.
Thank you, Saif. I'm very grateful for my colleagues for spending the time having the discussion about bladder cancer, one of my favourite topics. It's been very interesting to hear everyone's viewpoints and the similarities and some occasionally the difficult differences and the different perspectives from Valerie from Europe and both the surgical and oncology viewpoints. And I think great thanks to Lydia for joining us and giving us the most important perspective, which is that of our patients. And thank you very much for listening to this podcast and wishing you all the best.